everyone. Nice to speak to you again. Thank you for tuning in and for listening to Red Eyes Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, where free speech is effectively going to be outlawed and where you're soon to be prosecuted for your opinions and critical examination, not only of our elected leaders, but also on issues of mass immigration and people in power in general. In other words, we are a leading role model country for what is to come in the rest of this brave new world order. So, you're welcome. I hope you enjoy. Nonetheless, as things are, I hope you are enjoying your day-to-day and that you're in the mood for some shocking opinions. You know, we cover a lot of different topics on this program, and we do so for the purposes of examining them, to learn more about them and to see if we agree with them or not, and to see if they hold any water in general. We examine history, politics, conspiracy, corruption, and an endless string of other topics. On redicecreations.com, you can find more of our programs, over a year of shows available for free. We spare you from commercial interruptions and ads on our websites. And on redicemembers.com, we have our full archives and all programs in their entirety, plus other material. Today, we've lined up both of our hours for free for you, as we do now and then, so that you can hear in full what our guest has to say on the topic of transhumanism and the accompanying set of suggestions that will drive humanity towards a tech-ridden world of an all-knowing and all-seeing digitized intelligence, where potentially mankind only will be a side note, a paragraph. Best-selling author Zoltán István is an American-Hungarian who has explored over 100 countries, many as a journalist for the National Geographic Channel, writing, filming, and appearing in dozens of television stories, articles, and webcasts. His work has also been featured by the New York Times Syndicate, Outside, San Francisco Chronicle, BBC Radio, NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox, Animal Planet, and the Travel Channel. In addition to his award-winning coverage of the war in Kashmir, he gained worldwide attention for pioneering and popularizing the extreme sport of volcano boarding. Zoltán later became a director for the international conservation group WildAid, leading armed patrolled units to stop the billion-dollar illegal wildlife trade in Southeast Asia. Back in America, he started various successful businesses, from real estate development to filmmaking to viticulture. He is a philosophy and religious studies graduate of Columbia University and resides in San Francisco with his daughter and physician wife. Zoltán recently published The Transhumanist Wager, and this is the book, the novel that we're going to talk about today. It's a fictional thriller describing apatheist Jethro Knights and his unwavering quest for immortality via science and technology. The novel recently was a number one bestseller in both philosophy and sci-fi visionary and metaphysical on Amazon. Zoltán also blogs for Psychology Today and the Huffington Post. We'll begin nice and easy in the first hour, examining the story in the novel and in general the philosophy of transhumanism. But hold on to your hat as we enter into the second hour, as we get onto some thin ice and distressing territory, what I'd like to call the dark side of eugenics transhumanism. And welcome, Zoltán. Thank you for being here with us today. It's nice to talk to you. How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me on your show.
You bet. Now, this is going to be very interesting, an interesting discussion I think we have ahead of us here. As someone who I agree with on a lot of your points and disagree on many others as well, it's going to be very interesting to ask you more about, I guess, your philosophy overall, the book that you've written, and the hypothetical scenario that you do describe in your novel. And, you know, usually we don't cover that much novels, I guess, because of the reason that reality and the experience of reality has enough interesting stories in it, history and dramatic characters and everything else. So we tend to stick to that environment. However, in this particular case, we are going to talk about the future, basically, and an area that none of us can know for sure. So this is, of course, something we need to speculate about and talk about the possibilities. But, you know, nonetheless, to kind of kick things off here, there's a lot of interesting things I read about in terms of how people connect your work with Ayn Rand's work, you know, Atlas Shrugged, The Fountainhead, the objectivist view, libertarian view, although, you know, she didn't like to use that term and whatnot. But and then there's another aspect to this, which has to do with the transhumanist aspect, which we're going to get into in more detail. And you're a former Natural Geographic journalist. So how did you get into transhumanism, Zoltan? Tell us about that first.
Sure. Well, and I'll tell you kind of also just about what is in the novel, The Transhumanist Wager, because it's almost an identical story. About the first third of the book is autobiographical. So I was in Vietnam in the demilitarized zone, the DMZ zone, covering a story for bomb diggers where, you know, rice farmers will end up trying to dig up metal bombs that are unexploded. There's millions and millions of unexploded bombs in that area, and they sell them for money. And the problem with that is that there's tons of landmines that are left over from the war 30, 40 years ago. And I was walking down, doing my filming, and my guide literally ran at me and pushed me out of the way, and we both fell to the ground. I was just about to step on a landmine. Now, in the novel, The Transhumanist Wager, the main character actually does step on a landmine, but it ends up being a dud. For me, after 4 years of covering war zones, this was one of the most traumatic moments that I have ever had in my life. I probably would not have survived the explosion of the landmine. And it really was the moment that I said, you know, I've been a journalist for, 10 years and 4 years with National Geographic. It's time to dedicate myself to the things that I really want to do. And I was always interested in transhumanism. You know, the field of transhumanism is basically using science and technology to move beyond the human body. And after almost dying in Vietnam, I decided that moment to come home and to begin dedicating all my time, my resources, my energy to the transhumanism movement. And as a writer, I thought the best way to do that is to write a novel. And The Transhumanist Wager is what I have arrived at.
So it's really a death experience. Is it fair to say fear of death that sparked it?
Yes. It is fear of death. It's also, I like to, perhaps the other side of the coin is to say, it's also a love of life. I'm not really afraid of dying per se, but I'm more afraid of losing the wonders that I have had. I've been lucky enough to travel all over, to experience many adventures. I have a wonderful family. These are things that motivate me to want to live longer. In fact, they motivate me to want to live indefinitely. So, the experience in Vietnam, and it wasn't only that experience. It was also being in a number of other conflict zones for a couple years before that really just made, and seeing death and seeing rape victims, seeing such atrocities that it really just made me say, wow, I want to do something that actually improves the world, that makes it so that people can live longer and live in the kind of safety that I think most of us want to live in. And, the book, while it's maybe very radical and very hardcore, ultimately it is a book that hopefully will get more people trying to live better, live longer, and live more fulfilled lives with the kind of the brilliant experience that they can get from just being alive in our universe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, definitely. We'll get into that then. So you knew about transhumanism before you had this experience, right? Was it something you covered, or how did you end up knowing about it?
So yes, I'd known for transhumanism for, a good 15 years before this, but like many other people, I thought it was a wonderful idea. I was, when I was in college studying philosophy and religion, I'd come across it a number of times, and it was a topic that I kind of knew that I wanted to do something with it. But it was not until the landmine experience that I was emotionally impacted to say, it is now time to do something for it. It's now time to do something because I'm getting older, and my parents are getting older at the same time, and I'm seeing other people get sick, that it was really time to do something directly for it. But yes, since I've been about 20, I've been very well aware of the concepts. In fact, it was a magazine article on cryonics at college that actually introduced me to the entire idea of living indefinitely or living forever, and to the whole transhumanism movement.
It's kind of a revolutionary type of socialism that is explained in a way, or a libertarian even transhumanism. Maybe we can, we can deconstruct this, of course. But I wanted to ask if your view differs a little bit generally from it, and if we, of course, can kind of, I guess, define transhumanism. We talk about it a lot on the program, but we do that very much from a skeptic and critical point of view. So how would you define it to us?
Yeah, sure. So I like to just use the Latin. In the Latin, if you just take the words transhuman, means beyond human. And that, for me, is the simplest way of looking at it. It's just saying, whatever it is that we're going to do with the transhumanism movement, we're trying to move beyond what the natural human being is, and that means artificial hearts, that means digital eyes, That means bionics or augmenting ourselves and stuff like that. That's, to me, what transhumanism is. Some people will say, hey, you know, the cell phone is transhuman or driving a car is transhuman. And of course, in theory, that's correct. But I like to think of transhumanism more in radical science and technology that significantly improves the human experience and helps to move beyond what is naturally possible for the human being.
Where would you draw the line between the next step of technology as opposed to the one we've been utilizing so far?
Well, I think biohacking for me is where most people, or at least in my opinion, we get into kind of what I would say is transhumanism. When you start talking about an artificial heart, or you start talking about something, even I would say chemotherapy for cancer patients is already a very transhuman technology. Vaccines, I would consider something transhuman. And of course, I consider iPhones and all that transhuman. But when I say it in popular culture, when I say it on, for example, in interviews, I like to just generally speak about the things that actually get someone to understand it's not their daily lives, it's where we're going next. And in that case, I would say something like an artificial heart, which is something that potentially in 5 to 10 years, you're going to be seeing surgeries for artificial hearts happen, not because people need better hearts, but because there are better hearts out there that are synthetic. And you're going to see all sorts of parts being replaced. As you probably have covered in your show before, they had the robotic arm, you know, that now attaches to the nervous system. And this is just happened last year. I think it was a Swedish university. And this is a remarkable breakthrough that they can now connect actually, you know, very simplistic robotic parts to the human nervous system. It's not that big of a jump to go from there to a much better human arm. So I have to wonder if in 5, 10, 15 years, probably 15 years, will people be amputating their good arm, a good arm, and putting on a better robotic arm, which will be 50 times stronger, which will have sensors that are maybe 1,000 times better than the human hand and touch and feel and stuff like that. And that's kind of what I like to say is popular transhumanism. However, you know, we as a species, we've been quite transhuman from probably the Renaissance on.
Yeah, technology is a very interesting, difference between us and everything else that we can witness in nature. There are some animals, of course, that do use tools, etc., but obviously not to the capacity that we do, because if we can get more into that later as well, just the historical kind of view on this. But give us a little bit of an outline of the book, if you will. Paint us a picture of the protagonist, Jethro Knights, and some of the challenges that he faces.
Well, absolutely. So the protagonist is Jethro Knights. And basically the book, really, when I just try to sum it down into, you know, one or two sentences, it's the story about one man who wants to live indefinitely using science and technology. And what's made the book so controversial is that he will do anything to live indefinitely. And most of the times when you speak about what somebody would do for their goal in life or for their passion, you know, there's a breaking point on how far they would go. They certainly wouldn't hurt other people, or they certainly wouldn't break laws and stuff like that. But Jethro, his highest priority in life is living indefinitely, and he would do anything to achieve that. In fact, one of the main points about the book is that I define morality in terms of human morality, or transhuman morality, is determined by the amount of time that an entity has left to live. So that means if you only have 5 years left to live as a transhumanist, you're going to start doing anything, radical things, to try to live forever. If that means taking 1,000 pills a day, it means taking 1,000 pills a day. If it means robbing a bank and trying to put all that money and all those resources into some type of immortality technology, that's what it means. Morality for the transhumanist, at least according to my book, is very much defined by the amount of time that you have left to live. And again, you asked this question earlier. That's where a lot of the other transhumanists would probably strongly disagree with, at least some of the older ones, with the intent and the ideas of the protagonist. However, you know, I decided when I wrote this book to try to create as extreme transhumanist as I could. And that's what Jethro Knights is. He is just simply someone who is completely single-minded and would literally do anything to live indefinitely.
And now, of course, I don't want to give too much away of the book, but I do hope that we can talk about some of the, you know, events that occur in the book, and of course kind of outline some of the issues that the character goes through, and then kind of compare it to possibility scenarios that we might be facing, and then kind of go from there. But is the book, in your view, a did you write it as this is the most plausible scenario, or did you write it because you felt that there was a need to tackle a certain potential scenario with the explanation of what unfolds in the book?
Well, and that's an excellent question, because the job of the artist, at least in my opinion, is to try to paint extremes. And when you paint an extreme, what you do is you lead a reader to a certain place where they can see the most dramatic, either blacks or white colors or grays or whatever color it is that they're looking at, whatever types of feelings and emotions you can create the most dramatic effect of that, then they will have a better perspective on where it is that they actually stand as a person. They stand on their sensibilities and viewpoints. And, ultimately this book is really about morals and philosophies. And, we can talk about anything on the book. I really never mind the spoilers, because I tell a lot of people, it's definitely a thriller, but really it's got so much philosophy in it that I don't think that many people pay attention to the storyline as much as they pay attention to the actual ideas in it. And so I think ultimately, as an artist, I want to paint the most extreme story. I don't necessarily think that this is ever going to happen. I don't necessarily know if I really would want something like this to happen. But I wanted to give transhumanists and other people that might become transhumanists a kind of example of how far they might need to go if it was their moment to shine in the sun, their moment to say, wow, I'm dying and I need to do something. Or, I wanted to give an exemplary kind of character that everyone can kind of look at and say, well, what would Jethro Knights do in this case? And I think that's the kind of passion the transhumanists need. I don't know if he's necessarily the perfect example for the movement, mm-hmm. but he's a very good example for how passionate and how much energy all of us that believe in this should be putting into it.
Yeah, no, definitely. There are some interesting things, of course, that happens and occurs in the book as well. We'll go through that in detail. But where does it connect with objectivism, would you say? I guess we could just talk briefly about Ayn Rand's philosophy and how what your stance on that is, because I did see a couple of other reviews as well of the book, Zoltan, that began to argue a little bit here in terms of where it, I guess, deviates as well from objectivism or some of the libertarian ideas of where it kind of takes different turns, etc. But what's your view on Ayn Rand's philosophy?
Sure. So, my background with Ayn Rand is that I have been an avid reader of all her works. I think I've read everything of hers, and I've read many things many times. In fact, for example, I've read The Fountainhead 13 times. Now, mostly the book has been compared, The Transhumanist Wager has been compared to Atlas Shrugged. In fact, I've now counted over 100 different comparisons in either reviews or in media things between that. So some people are saying this is a modern day Atlas Shrugged. And to some extent, I appreciate that. But I must say that I honestly don't believe that Ayn Rand would be a fan of The Transhumanist Wager. I think she'd probably find it fascinating. But I know that it deviates strongly from objectivism. I think The Transhumanist Wager, if you have to look at a single philosopher, it's much more closely aligned with Nietzsche, with Friedrich Nietzsche, mm-hmm. and some of his kind of bolder ideas, especially with the will to power and stuff like that. That said, I have been such a longtime fan of Ayn Rand, and there are many elements of objectivism in The Transhumanist Wager. There are many, many, especially elements of the integrity of the artist. And instead of an artist in The Transhumanist Wager, it's Jethro Knights, who's essentially a leader, a philosopher, politician. And so his integrity is taken very much from the classic kind of John Galt or Ayn Rand character. So while I am, I'm sort of torn between the comparisons to Ayn Rand and not, because on one hand, I'm thrilled, having grown up with her books. On the other hand, I realize I made an effort to promote a philosophy, and the philosophy in the book is called TEF, or teleological egocentric functionalism, and it's a very different type of philosophy than objectivism. While it does contain some elements, many elements of objectivism, it goes much further than Ayn Rand ever would have gone. It also incorporates ideas that she could never have understood. She had never understood the idea of bionics, artificial intelligence, quantum mechanics. These are things, simply that did not exist when she was writing Atlas Shrugged back in, I think, the 50s.
Right.
So, you know, many things have changed from that point, and that's where I hope the Transhumanist Wager adds something much more meaningful to kind of the philosophical body of knowledge than objectivism ever did.
So while Nietzsche perhaps would be a transhumanist then with some of his, you know, supermensch kind of ideas and everything else, do you think Ayn Rand would be?
It's very tough to say where she would be with the way the world has evolved. Because what's happened, I think, in the, you know, since she wrote Atlas Shrugged, which is 60, 70 years now, is that technology has really exponentially grown. And it has given us things like iPhones and, you know, views into the universe and physics that never could have existed back then. You know, back then it really was, okay, A equals A. Now we know from a lot of the different, you know, physics that are out there that, you know, if there's multiple universes or multiple dimensions and stuff like that, maybe A no longer equals A. In fact, that could be the entire ticket to the whole universe. And the Transhumanist Wager tries to incorporate some of that, not black and white, but grayness. In fact, in the character of Zoe Bock, I specifically bring her in there to make to kind of balance Jethro out, because I just can't I can't believe A equals A anymore. Not given how many developments there have been in modern physics.
Right, right. So we have a couple of things here that we could, of course, talk more about, and it has to do with. Well, it's interesting because I wanted to get into a little bit more about how you, what the general view, I guess, is here of development and both nature as well, and how you see that the task of what the task of mankind is, or, you know, in the sense that we could, of course, take charge in a different way than animals can. We can use our rational mind. We can do things. We can create tools with it. Is the progress, the development always a positive and good thing in your view, Zoltan?
Well, of course, in my view, it is. But I don't want to be that person that completely does not understand the other side. As I've told many people, the Transhumanist Wager and my ideas can be taken both as inspiration or as a warning. Things can go bad, and especially when we discuss something like artificial intelligence, which I consider perhaps the most brilliant thing that could happen in the next 20 years, and by far the most dangerous thing as well. So I, in general, believe that development is good, and I've been actually working on an article recently and discussing, you know, using statistical showings of some of the UN reports saying that, in fact, technology has improved the standard of living for most people around the world. The problem, though, is that it has not fixed suffering. It has not fixed starvation. Has not fixed disease. So it has not done enough yet. So when you promote something like that, it doesn't always come out sounding that good. In general, I do believe that development leads us to a better place. But as with anything that happens in life, one has to be really careful that the way they steer development goes in a good way. I'm not a fan of, you know, myself losing my life or my control or my family's lives because technology runs rampant here in 20 years and all of a sudden a new species of artificial intelligence wipes out the planet. For me, that's not an acceptable form of transhumanism. I know some people, like, you know, say I really push evolution, but I don't push evolution when it eliminates me. You know, the idea of my sense of transhumanism and my sense of the beliefs that I have are that it promotes the things that I love, the things that I value. And as I do value society and I do value individuals and I do value the planet, I want to make sure that we protect all those things. At the same time, I realize that development is not going to be friendly to everything. And, you know, and here we get into this difficult subject. Well, how far and how fast do we push with development and especially technological development? And, you know, the answer is we push as fast as we can as long as it's good, I think, for the species as a whole. If we get to a point when there's a certain segment of the species that starts leaving the rest of us behind, I'm not there, I'm going to tell you that that's not a good thing at all.
Right, right. Well, it's just so many interesting, you know, avenues from this point that we can take, and so many things that I want to discuss from this standpoint alone. Of course, we could get into who determines the value judgment of what is good to all in humanity, and of course, some would really argue, I guess, that the progress in itself has led to a lot of detrimental things. Although I agree with you as well, it has also taken a lot of people, for example, out of poverty, creating material, you know, welfare in that regard, and made life generally easier. The question, though, is as well, is technology something that is there to remedy and fix, if not all, the majority of the problems in the world?
What an incredible question, because, I'll try to be honest with you. I don't know if I have the answer for you. I can just only give you my opinion on that one. I struggle with this late at night when I'm drinking wine. If there's a spiritual side that technology cannot address, then clearly technology falls short on that end. In my book, again, Zoe Bach represents that side of the story. And I think in my sequel, I will also further address that, because as much as I believe in very, hardcore logic and hardcore functionality, there's always an element of needing to wonder, wanting to ask why. Perhaps we're missing something. I don't want to say I'm quasi-spiritual or anything like that, but I want to remain open to the fact that I could be wrong about technology being the greatest thing that's ever happened. And so, the question then becomes, well, what is it to, as we advance as species, what is it that's going to bring us the most meaning? What is it that's going to bring us the best evolutionary path? And so far, it seems to be that, we want to address a lot of the basic factors, hunger, thirst, clothing, shelter, all those basic things. We're way beyond that at this point. So now we're starting to address things of power and things of experience. But experience gets into, I think, a bit more of a spiritual idea, which is, well, what is experience? Is it just being happy, or is it just being fulfilled, or is it seeing more things and understanding more things, the size of our brain, complexities? Those kind of questions, they get very nebulous very quickly. And while I think technology can help us understand all of them, I'm always going to remain open to the fact that there might be a spiritual aspect I'm missing. There might be a simulation theory, that we're in some simulated universe, mm-hmm. and that there has been a program put inside it just to trick us, and that we need to remain open to that so that we can understand that. Maybe the trickery in the universe, let's say hypothetically, is where we're going to end up, and that will be the most important aspect to us. So, well, I very much am pro-technology and believe that it's the greatest vehicle to transcending ourselves and evolving. I think most importantly, even beyond that, is always this idea of curiosity and the ability to ask why. If we come to a point when we can no longer say that technology is working for us, no longer taking us to better places, then yes, we'll have to look at other avenues of thought.
What do you think that the attraction to technology is rooted in, if we talk a little bit about human psychology? Is there a reason why we're so pulled and attracted to it, as opposed to, let's say, being content with what we have in the world, right? Of living simply, I guess, or something like that. Is there something else? I mean, this is of course more prominent at this stage, or has been in the past at least, as an initiation force in the Western world, of course. But what's at the root of that, do you think?
Well, I have a bit of a strange answer, and I discuss this a bit in my book, is that I don't believe technology is democratic at all. I don't think technology favors equality whatsoever. I think technology is almost like the animals on the plains of Africa, survival of the fittest. And I think for many of us, that's a very deeply rooted thing in our brain. However, in the 21st century, in a world of, in a civilized world where we have laws and rules and things that keep us in place, and things that keep us from beating each other over the head with bats all day long, technology offers this ability to get something that is not, necessarily right or wrong from a kind of a human social point of view, but it just simply is. Does it work or does it not work? It's very functional. And I think that's something that many humans miss in their daily lives. As they walk outside their door, they get on a train, they drive around, they have a mortgage, they have health insurance. There's a lot of things like that that I think we're missing. And in this sense, I think technology really is something, at least when I see it, when I hear some of the radical stuff, I think, wow, that's amazing. That's exactly the kind of functionality that I dream of. And of course, this could be something just simply in my brain, and maybe most people don't see this, but I make a real many different points in the book about saying how it's the functionality that really I'm attracted to with technology. And I believe a lot of other people are. I think deeply, philosophically, that's what makes iPhones or cell phones so attractive, or cars, is that ultimately it just gives us the flexibility and the functionality to very quickly do whatever it is that we want to do in a way that's expedient, in a way that gets it to whatever our destination is much quicker, so we can kind of repeat that process. And it's just so much more satisfying. But I do believe it's deeply rooted in a process that is, I would like to say, just not democratic. And therefore, we are attracted to it, because in most of our lives, everything's so civil, everything's so constrained, everything's so organized that it can be a little bit, disconcerting, at least to me. Whereas technology is just, it's this way or it's no way. And that's what I love about it.
Well, it's a very interesting point. I mean, I'm not personally upset with the idea that it has to be democratic, right? There is an element of pathological altruism out there. And this is why I've partially been attracted to some of the ideas within objectivism and within Ayn Rand's philosophy. I'm not obsessed with that idea that everything has to be fair and, you know, all the time. I think there's, if we honestly look at the development of anything in nature, we see this aspect that you talked about of competition for a very specific purpose, of a general idea that this is how you attain things and develop them forward. And what's interesting here too is, of course, that you could mention the same about the development of technology, that this has sprung out of a competitive reaction. I mean, if we look at the history of human warfare, for example, this has probably been the one and the foremost aspiring concept that we need to develop a better technology to resist your enemies, right? To protect yourself, to do anything. I mean, a sword, that's technology right there. So it kind of comes out of this environment, right? And so the question is, at what point now do we stand in for when we're potentially able to circumvent that nature? Circumventing the idea of the survival of the fittest, even with the technology, I guess, because at this stage, it's more about resources and potentially monetary kind of a question, as opposed to who as a human being would be the most fit, if you know what I mean, to lead this quest forward. So there are a couple of things in there that I kind of want to get a little closer to, and how you view that. Let's look at the history first. The development of technology is coming out of human warfare, right? And that's not a necessarily a very democratic idea, right? So would you agree with that?
Oh yeah, 100%. I think, and you know, just as probably your listeners know, that some of the most incredible transhuman technology being developed right now is for military purposes. When you hear you hear about drones, you know, this is a classic transhuman technology. It's an incredible kind of development that's happened. And I think a lot of people in the last 2 years have realized, and in fact, I hear this all the time from the layperson who says, I didn't really know about transhumanism until I really started paying attention to drones, because drones is something that affects all of us. They're talking about in my neighborhood now, setting up drones in the sky. You know, they're going to cover 6 miles, a 6 mile radius area. And they're going to look at thefts. They're going to look at robberies. And this is a local police force. You know, it's only $50,000-$60,000 to have one of these things. They just sit up there in the sky and float around and look at things. They're talking about Amazon delivering packages. And these are the kind of technologies that, when people don't really think, you know, you usually think of transhumanism as in terms of your body. But it's really going to be in all sorts of other technologies coming out. And of course, drones have begun their lives as military, in military usage, and they're going to continue so. In fact, they're probably going to make it so warfare is not something that is people actually get hurt in anymore. It's just like video games. And but anyways, it's just one of those classic technologies that came out of a very non-democratic process, and it just came from a very functional point of view. And, you know, it's hard to see where it's going to end, but it's going to grow incredible until a point of, you know, currently I was reading the other day that my daughter, a three-year-old, goes to school. And I thought, you know, it'd be nice to have a little drone following her all the time, just to always know where she is, to make sure she's safe. I can easily see in 5-10 years that a product like that will be out there, and we'll be able to help her. And in a case of emergency or something like that. And everyone says, oh, that's going to invade on our property, our, you know, our whatever it is, what we feel security and stuff like that with the NSA. And of course it will. But, these are kind of some of the ethical dilemmas that everyone's going to have to face in saying, well, how much safety is worth it? You know, and I don't have all the answers for that, but I sort of know what I would like for my own children. And I sort of give up a lot of my own sense of privacy when it comes to protecting my children.
Oh, you do? Really?
Well, I don't right now, but I'm willing to. As I was discussing with my wife, I would love to have something where, you know, my daughter could have something injected into her arm. She could always be tracked. She could always be, you know, monitored. We could always, for example, you know, we have a 5-week-old baby right now. And I know there's some products right now where you can already put something onto her chest. And then it sends to your iPhone and it kind of monitors her heartbeats. So if you're sleeping, you know, and this is a big worry. You have SIDS to worry about, which is, you know, where children under one year old, they either suffocate or die or something like that. And this might be one way to help monitor that. About, I think, one out of 113 children the first year die from SIDS. So these are the kind of things in technology, transhuman technologies, I think could really be helpful. And, you know, I don't want to say I'm a paranoid person, but I like to use these things for the benefit of all. And if I could have something that's monitoring my 5-week-old child who currently has had the flu for 3 or 4 days, and I can tell you it hasn't been very easy sleeping, it'd be really nice to monitor her blood levels. It'd be really nice to monitor her heartbeat levels. It'd be really nice to have something tell me that this is the point that we actually need to take her to the hospital because the flu has gotten so bad. You know, it'll have a built-in thermometer, so we'll always be able to know her temperature. It's not this thing we have to go buy at a Safeway or a market and then come back and load the battery and try to keep it in her mouth. It'll be built in. And these are some incredible technologies that are literally right on the horizon. In fact, they're going to be having baby suits, suits that you put your baby in, just normal clothing, wearable technology that monitors all this kind of stuff. It's already been, it's being experimented on right now, and you'll probably see in the next 2 to 3 years. It'll be very expensive at first, but, you know, it will really change the way at least people like me deal with infants, because it is a little bit of a harrowing kind of experience to, you know, have this 5-week-old thing just still barely breathing.
So that system is kind of going to help you out a little bit in terms of parenting. Is that what you're saying?
Very much so. And it's also going to help me with just feeling better. I'm still, I'm not sure about how others feel, but I'm, you know, holding a 5-week-old baby in my arms is still a very delicate process. I feel very fragile with the whole thing. And I would like more technology to make me feel better about that.
This is very interesting. Let me ask you a little bit. I mean, I don't think you mentioned it before that you didn't want to sound paranoid. I think it's quite the opposite. You sound very trusting and very open. I would say definitely too much so when we think about the scenario that we do face right now when it comes to the sinister application of the surveillance technology, Big Brother, you mentioned it yourself, NSA, the drones, the very infrastructure that are being built around us now. And then what's interesting to me is that you have, on top of this, you do have the defense budgets, you do have an extraordinary amount of money being poured into the research. If we look at things like DARPA, of course, Boston Dynamics in terms of some of the robotics they're developing. And I'm seeing these convergence point at some point here. And that's also something I want to try to get a little bit closer to here later, of talking about what some of the possibility scenarios is when all of this kind of comes together. Nonetheless, before we do that, I want to ask you a little bit more about what you know in terms when it comes to not only wearable technology, but also microchip implants and some of the things that have been done so far in terms of the develop of cancer around the lesions where the microchips are. We have issues with wearable technology now because of the petrochemical usage alone in these products, where, for example, have BPA plastics and phthalates and everything else that actually are changing the hormone system, the endocrine system of the people who are wearing this kind of stuff. And I think this is something that will come as an increase with everything that we're doing to our bodies. And I'm seeing this as a kind of a clash in a situation here where we have an idea of what we want to do. And we have an idea that is going to solve all these issues or be helpful. It's going to be safer and everything else. But then on the flip side of that argument, you of course have the danger of the state itself, which you very much critique in the book, which is also something we need to get to, that those in charge of the technology is the government at this stage, right? So that's another problem. But What do you think about the idea that the more we try to apply to better ourselves and to help ourselves, there is another slew of issues and problems and sickness and things that kind of comes as a wave against us? I don't know how familiar we are with that, but what do you make of that then?
Well, no, and that's a great point. And that has always been one of the challenges with technology. I mean, the very first thing that happened when people, first got the automobile was there was a huge increase on the deaths from driving accidents, because all of a sudden you could race down the road at 50 miles per hour. And it took a while for people to say, wait a sec. So yes, we can get somewhere very quickly, but that's actually dangerous too, because we can crash and die. And with the horse carriages, it was much slower, laborious. It just didn't happen so frequently. So that happens with all technologies. And when you talk about some of these bands that people are wearing, and yes, they're getting skin rashes and stuff like that, I think that's, of course, not good at all that companies are allowing, developing things that give people skin rashes and stuff like that. But I also see it from a philosophical point of view saying, well, it's just the beginning. And hopefully in 2 years, they will perfect it. They will get it so that, okay, there's no skin rash coming from whatever they're wearing or some of the stuff like that. And when they're dealing with some of the microchips in it, yes, there's going to certainly be a certain amount of stuff that happens. There were some terrible vaccines 20, 30 years ago that they introduced that gave people all sorts of deformations with birthing and stuff like that.
And they still do. A lot of issues that have it. We have a scenario now lately in Sweden where we have all these young girls who were given the HPV vaccine and they have narcolepsy and everything else. There's tons of issues with it. And I guess that's one of the points I'm getting to here as well, that there is a continued, the more that the development comes and we think that we're taking ourselves out of the situation, it's a pervasive issue that is still there. And either, people are aware of it or they're not, but it's still going on, right?
No, it is very much. And, and I think the answer to solving that problem is hopefully the people of the world, and especially I think nonprofits, getting together and forcing when some company like that makes a bad choice, that they suffer for it, that they get reprimanded in such a way that it makes them not want to do that. I feel like there's a lot of companies that get away with some awful things. And I know some of them are protected by the government, and I know that some. And I'm not a big giant fan of big companies that go off and do things that hurt the general populace. I generally feel that anything that's anti-transhumanist or anything that hurts life extension or hurts extended longevity is, in my opinion, wrong and bad and needs to be changed. So essentially, we need to, as a kind of a society, make sure that as we progress with these technologies, we take an extra step forward and say, well, is this really going to help us? Should we put extra monitoring on this company as they're about to do that? Now, of course, unfortunately, a lot of the monitoring already, like in America, the FDA is monitoring, certain drugs that come out, and then they make it so that it takes too long to come out. So, It's a give and take, as any kind of form of technological evolution is going to be. People need to be very careful, and people need to step up and try to protect themselves and their loved ones in society. But at the same time, they want to get these benefits. So there has to be a good fine line so that we don't hurt ourselves as a species, and at the same time, we're able to make ourselves live better and longer. It's a subtle dance.
I would say that the government is more of an enabler to a certain extent than the big corporations, because the government protect the big corporations. So if they would to stand on their own, and if people were aware of it, if they were intelligent, it could piece these pieces together, they would understand more clearly in that regard which are the bad guys, and people would just not buy from them or support them in that regard, and the company would stand and fall on their own, right, instead of having all these restrictions in there from government. So in that regard, that's where I'm a more libertarian and agree with some of the Ayn Rand philosophies, But at the same time, then I'd say that in that instance, when you have the government so powerful as it is today, you have a tremendous danger here when it comes to the very infrastructure of surveillance that they're building up right now. Not only that, I mean, we could certainly talk more about that, how you view, for example, your child being a cog in that machine of immense profile building, data mining, and everything else that can be achieved with the ubiquitous technology that we have around us. But we also have the issue of hackers, for example, that could tap into your child's, RFID chip or even a microchip or worse, a brain computer interface or something like that, spying upon the children, that's not even talking about the medical issues that arise from it, as I mentioned before. But so is your approach then, Zoltan, that it's with more technology and more development that we're simply going to solve these issues, or where do you stand on these points?
Yes, so I definitely support more technology. I generally think more technology is the answer. And I used a kind of a statistical basis of just lifespans and better lives and longer lives and just kind of more resources and wealth being attributed to civilization as a result of technological process. Technological progress. However, I'm very much with you in that I am worried myself about a surveillance state. I'm worried myself that this can get out of hand. I'm worried myself. One of the classic worries is that in a small, tiny elite group of people can then take over everything, that you can be hacked by anyone just because the government wasn't good enough in monitoring, you know, the hackers and stuff like that. And I can tell you there's a lot of mean-spirited people out there that just going to go for themselves or just want to do bad things just to do bad things. So I believe that technology is going to be helpful for the greater good. I do think along the way, there's going to be huge amounts of complaints about all the problems that technology creates. And this is kind of going back to the automobile and car accidents. I am still a believer, though, that ultimately, the more resources we spend on technology, the more development we spend on it, the more careful we are with implementing it with other safety measures and stuff like that, the better the species will be as a whole, and that will be good, you know, for the greater good. That said, one of the reasons I even wrote my novel was to try to get people aware of these issues at hand. It amazes me how few people really understand how quickly technology is progressing. I was just reading on the cover of the New York Times the other day that they now have lasers that they're shooting into rats and actually turning off their minds and then turning them back on. You know, like there's these. So this is a precursor for instead of your iPhone, you tapping stuff, you thinking stuff. So you're going to soon be able to do stuff like that. And I'm not soon when I mean 10, 20, 30 years. But the fact that they're already experimenting with it is showing how fast it's growing. And, you know, here people come home and turn on their television and watch the latest sitcom without realizing that around the world, you know, billions and billions of dollars are being put into technology that is literally going to change the species.
Exactly. It's very worrying in that regard, because we have to begin with awareness, right? And if you're not aware of what actually is possible with the technology, that's when you, of course, can be manipulated by it. And then we're back in the situation of, okay, who controls the technology? There's a number of scenarios there that we could discuss. One of them, of course, is this idea, of course, that the development in itself occurs in secret, right? That you have a small minority that, and again, I'm not saying necessarily that I'm against the development of anything like that, or even that someone shouldn't be allowed to develop it. But nonetheless, it's a scenario that arises from this situation. I think if we look at anything in history again, we can't set ourselves outside of that parameter. At some point, there was someone who developed a sword that was stronger than the other guys, right? And who's going to come in there and say, no, you can't do that. It has to be fair, right? It was just something that occurred, and either the other guy stepped up to the plate and managed to be there and part of it and rise to the challenge, if you will, in that regard. But is that how you view the ongoing transhumanist kind of endeavor as well? Is it that struggle? Is it that kind of, you know, race to the finish line and kind of any means necessary, right? Because there are scenarios like that in the book as well, that this is the way to protect, you know, transhumania, right? Is to, by any means necessary, whatever we have to do, that is going to occur because the development itself is the goal and nothing is going to stop that. Is that how you view this?
Well, so I'm somewhat split on exactly that question. I view it as something that is absolutely necessary. To what extent should we, when I say absolutely necessary, to what extent should we go through with it? Well, you know, to cause a world war, you know, what an incredibly difficult question. If it means, though, getting the broader species, in especially in the case of the book, which is much more black and white, you know, it's good versus evil in some respects. Yes, that was a kind of a no-brainer. In the real world, though, the way this is going to unfold is it's still, let's work for the greatest good. Let's try to bring technology to the masses so that everyone can live longer, because everyone in itself is valuable. And frankly, the system is completely dependent upon, you know, everyone. I don't like to think that, you know, we can take out a certain portion of the population and continue the way we are. I think we're sort of interdependent on very many people. And That said, there are, of course, leaders, and there are certain innovators who take us way further than we have been. But as a rule, everything is sort of interdependent, going back to even these big companies and the big government. It's very difficult for the government to control a big company. I mentioned this in the book, and it's very difficult for a big company to control its product because there's so many levels of people doing so many different things that the communication, it's like a big giant rolling monster. And that's one of the difficult problems with culture. And this is why, like, as a transhumanist, I like to skip a lot of that and just say, you know what, let's work for the technology, and the technology will set everything straight. But in the real world, that becomes much more conflicting, because I had recently written an article for the Huffington Post called If You Want to Live Longer, Support a Life Extension Tax, a Jethro Knight's Life Extension Tax. And the idea is really simple. It says everybody donate 1% of their net worth, and we will have, a couple $1 trillion, and then we'll be able to conquer death in 10 years. We'll organize a bunch of different companies and whatnot and spread those couple $1 trillion into the life extension field. And all of a sudden, I promise you, within 10 years, we'll have the cure to death. Frankly, a lot of experts sort of think that if we had that, those kind of resources going into longevity, we would be able to do that. Currently, we have nowhere near those amounts of resources. If we have even $100 billion going towards that right now, it would be a dream. It's much smaller than that already. The point of the story, though, is that it would be great to kind of get big companies, government, an earth-wide approach, a civilization-wide approach towards solving some of these problems. It's not likely to happen that way, though, because the way technology works is it kind of happens little spurts here and there, and there are big little jumps forward, and not everyone gets to benefit quickly from it. So in the future, though, I'm hoping that perhaps with better communication, more globalization, we'll be able to better harness those jumps and make it so that the whole world can benefit from transhumanist technology and not have something like the book unfold, where culture, especially religious culture and culture of conservatism and stuff like that, actually gets in the way from us developing things that are in the best interest of the species overall.
Well, here, this is very interesting. And of course, here's very much where we do disagree. Do you think that death is a mistake in nature, Zoltan?
I don't want to say it's a mistake. I'm not even sure I believe in really the word mistake, but I think it's not good enough for me. And I think there's many millions of people around the world that also say it's not good enough for them. It's simply that we can do better than that. There's just no reason to die if we can overcome it. As I point out in this article, this life extension article, yes, there'll be many complications, namely overpopulation, global warming, some of the other problems that are very real and that we already suffer from. But I believe that those problems can be dealt with through technology, through technological fixes, but overcoming our own mortality, that for me is the single most important concern of the species itself and certainly of myself. I believe that while I wouldn't say it's a mistake, it's something that can be overcome, and we can find a much better way around that so that the lives that we have can be preserved if we want them to be preserved. I think some people will always probably want to die. I think that's I don't want to use the word unnatural, but I want to say it is a flawed system of thought, if you love life. At the same time, I think it's something important to always respect.
All right. Well, we're just really getting started here. They're just the more we talk, the more kind of questions I have about this to try to understand the philosophy more and a number of points out as well that I want to challenge your belief with, Zoltan. But let's take a short break here, and then we'll pick up again after the break. There's, as I said, much, much more to get into. We're just really getting started here. But give us some details again about the websites that you have where people can find your work, where they can pick up a copy of the novel if they want to read more about it. So please go ahead, Zoltan.
Yeah, absolutely. So the easiest way to get the novel is on Amazon. There's both a paperback version and an ebook version. It's called The Transhumanist Wager. Just go to whatever Amazon in whatever country you're in, and it'll show up right there for you, and just get it. It's in a few bookstores. It's also in Barnes & Noble, but Amazon is the easiest way to get it, and I think also the cheapest. And then I also have a website, transhumanistwager.com or zoltanistvan.com, and you can look at all my work there. And lastly, you know, if you just Google Zoltan Istvan, you can look at a lot of my National Geographic stuff, a lot of my new articles. I have a blog for the Huffington Post and a blog for Psychology Today titled The Transhumanist Philosopher. So there's just a lot of stuff out there if you just want to Google it to find out more information. But my the majority of my thought and my philosophy is incorporated into my novel, The Transhumanist Wager.
All right, lots of links there for you, transhumanistwager.com, the main website. We'll have this and other links up as well from redicecreations.com, so check it out right there. All right, we'll take a short break. We'll return with Zoltan here in a little bit. Stay with us. We'll be right back. And welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Zoltan Istvan about his book, The Transhumanist Wager, and everything that's connected to the very, basic and fundamental philosophy. And we do disagree on a lot of points, Zoltan and myself, but that doesn't, of course, stop us from talking about this stuff and try to figure it out and try to understand on what level, what direction, Zoltan wants to move into to try to better the human race. I think that's one thing that we have in common, all of us, right? It's the betterment of what we are, what we do here, what we are. And the only question, of course, is how we do that. That's the disagreement in this case. Let's get a little bit more philosophical here, right out of the gates in the second segment here, Zoltan, and just talk a little bit more about how you view nature overall. And if you have an idea that nature is something that's there for us, ripe for the picking, and we can certainly get into a little bit more about why we are different, you know, and that's of course a epistemological kind of issue in itself of what sets us apart. But how do you view nature? Is there a behind the design of nature, is there a purpose there, shall we say?
Sure. Well, I have a twofold perspective on it. And this is actually going back to what we discussed a little bit ago with Ayn Rand, was I do believe that nature is there for us to use. I don't think it's either a positive or a negative value. I just think whoever can get to nature should be able to utilize it in whichever way they want. And I'm not necessarily speaking just from, you know, being a human or being a transhuman. I'm speaking from kind of any kind of living form or anything else out there that has to utilize nature. So that's one thing. But the other thing is built into my philosophy, the TEF, the teleological egocentric functionalism, which is the main philosophy of the transhumanist wager, is this idea of teleological. And the word teleological means something that is done by design, something that has design built into it. And I am a firm believer that evolution, at least in itself, at least from a point of living forms organizing and evolving on planet Earth, have this teleological direction built into it, meaning that evolution is something that is what we do. That's just our way of organized life, way of moving forward. And so that's one of the reasons how I even justify transhumanism, is I just believe that it's completely the most natural way for a transhumanist to progress, to evolve, to get better, to get smarter, to do more things with whatever they can in the universe. And so while I think the universe itself is sort of a neutral playground, I think we have this built-in ability, this built-in drive to want to organize and advance and simply become more complex and, dare I say, more brilliant.
Right. Now, so how do you view the information overall and knowledge and application of the things that we learn? It seems very much to me that the concepts that lies within the transhumanist concept is that we will be able to, you know, connect our minds to a worldwide database that might even be overseen by some kind of artificial intelligence or something that kind of distributes. It seems, what's interesting to me is that where the contradiction comes in the philosophical concept is the more anti-collectivist, you know, kind of a little bit. I know, again, I might be pressing the Ayn Rand issue a little bit too much here then, but there's an anti-collectivism sentiment there to me, and I think you'd generally agree with that. But within the confines of transhumanism, is very much of a kind of a collectivist ideal. There is very much a consensus situation that occurs within the fact that there is a centralization of information, of the database, of the accepted knowledge, even perhaps, and this very question of if more and more and more is truly better, right? Because most cases we have more information than we can handle right now, even with the web, for example. But in most cases, people instinctively just kind of almost turn away from it. It's overload. It's too much for them, right? So is more always better?
And you know, that's an amazing question, because I think one of the things that's happening here is, you know, as humans evolve, the problem is that some aspects of human development are different. You know, it's not just we're growing, you know, our brains are adapting, or this is adapting, or that's adapting. We're multifaceted creatures. We have many different things happening on many different levels and many different forms of evolutionary development. For example, technology is growing a lot quicker than our biological brain. However, once we can get to a technological point when we can connect the biology of our brain into, let's say, a computer or an artificial intelligence, as we had discussed earlier with the robotic arm tapping into the nervous system, then we might be able to harness all that that much more information that much more quickly. Currently, it seems like technology has sort of started to pull away, and there's more information than we can handle. I agree with you. I can't answer any more emails than I get a day already. I'm pooped out. However, you know, tap myself into a couple servers I'm going to have in my closet in hopefully 10, 15, 20 years, maybe 30 years. And that might be a very different animal. We might be able to, you know, as I point out in my book, if we have brains filled, servers filled with the size of the Empire State Building, and all of a sudden that is our capacity, our complexity, which could be, I don't know, 1,000, maybe 1,000,000 times more connections than, let's say, our human brain, all of a sudden we can handle that much more information. So yes, right now it's seeming that we're being overloaded, but that's where technology is going to help us later. We just need to catch up and be able to put in larger memory banks into our brains.
All right. Well, I mean, biology, certainly that's an interesting aspect in itself there, that it does not catch up. It takes a longer process. And I think that there is that's where I take a more naturalist view. I'm not a Luddite. Of course not. I use technology. I to some extent, appreciate it almost to the point where I enjoy it very much because of the fact that what it enables me to do, you know. Then at the same time, there are clear distinctions, I guess, where I draw the line in terms of the invasiveness of the technology in itself, right? And so to me, it seems a little bit of a catch-22, the scenario that we're in right now. I can just, for example, take an example with Twitter or something like that, right? We've entered into a realm now where the quickness of the technology itself enables us to read more online, to read other people's, you know, links or whatever, and follow, you know, 1,000 people, 10,000 people, 100,000 people. And it's more than we can process with our human minds. It's just not doable. So with that, we try to take the computer processing power into effect, connected with our brains to be able to process more. But at some point, you realize that we're entering into kind of like this beehive society, right? We process more for the sake that we can process more. And when we can process more, we always need more processing power to be able to process all the information that we... Do you see what I'm saying? It's like a catch-22 kind of scenario. And so my overall bigger question is, where is this going? And is the value of the information itself something that is so valuable that we need to change our biology and update our brains and our entire being and potentially wreck ourselves in the process for the sake of keeping up with the high-speed infrastructure that mankind up to this point have developed?
Well, you know, again, a fascinating question. And my answer is that we are probably all going to do that. We're all probably going to join some kind of giant mind hive, artificial intelligence inspired kind of brain where we are probably all interconnected. Again, this is very speculative and very philosophical and somewhat of the subject matter of my sequel as well, that at some point we're going to be much more connected than we are right now. Now, that said, important things here is as technology develops, we're going to be able to taste all these types of new ideas as they happen. So we're going to be able to say to ourselves, okay, today I'm downloading my brain into a computer, or I'm enabling my brain with a type of computer chip, which then gives me 100 times more computing power, thinking power, and I have better vision, I have better this. We're going to move slowly. And I think what's going to happen is we will answer a lot of these questions along the way. Right now, it's very easy for us to say, oh, this is great, or this is awful. But unfortunately, none of us have the exact idea of what it's going to be like. I used this in one of my articles recently when I said, you know, if you had told somebody in 1914, 100 years ago, that most people on the planet are going to have the ability to do video conferencing from this little tiny screen that they hold in their hand, a cell phone. If you said that to somebody in 1914, they would have said, well, why do I even want that? And that sounds crazy and it sounds unimaginable. But the truth is we all can do it, even some very poor people, you know, wherever they may live, have cell phones and this ability to do. We adjust with technology. People, individuals adjust as technology comes, because it never just comes where all of a sudden it's like, oh, the internet happened. Actually, for most people, the internet sort of took place over 2 or 3 or 4 years. I was introduced to it in college. I then started using it a little bit more, a little bit of email. Then I got involved in designing websites. Then I got involved in, you know, buying things from Amazon. It wasn't like all of a sudden one day we were immersed into this environment and that was it. We actually took some time to go there. And so I think at the same time, this will also take time. Over the next 20 to 40 years, humanity, civilization will have a good chance to take steps forward and also take steps back as they decide how far they want to go. I don't like the idea of losing my individuality, so I'm not sure the mind hive concept works for me. But I think it's going to be one of those things where you can go in and out of slow enough where you'll be able to really get a feel for it and then make a choice, kind of like marriage. You know, you get to know your spouse ahead of time, and then at some point you make that commitment if it works, and you can get divorced.
I just I just got married right away, and it worked like a charm, you know. So my wife's American; she came up to Sweden, and we fell in love right away there. What I'm saying is that there are those kinds of scenarios that break that rule, I guess, right? So.
No, definitely. There are, of course. There's going to be an exception to every rule.
Sure.
So,
okay. One of the issues there then potentially that you're kind of alluding to a little bit is the idea that we have a potential, the technological singularity comes into the picture at some stage here. Artificial intelligence that basically is going to aid us in the process of solving the issues that we yet today cannot even fathom. Those things that will arise that we cannot solve. Therefore, these are things that are going to be, to a certain extent, it's almost an approach which is kind of like a higher intelligence will solve the things for us, so we do not need to worry about them today. Would you say that that's a fair assessment if we talk a little bit about the technological singularity and that things might be so different that we cannot even imagine it, therefore we shouldn't even worry about it?
Well, I definitely take that perspective to some extent. And I realize that, as many of my critics will say, that borders on religious thinking almost, because you have faith in some type of thing that's going to happen that hasn't happened yet, and we have no idea if it's going to be a tragedy or something brilliant. But I do believe that we have a statistical history of technology emerging, solving problems, creating new problems, and then technology, again, emerging something new, solving and creating new problems. And I believe that as long as, like I said, for me, going back to lifespans, as long as lifespans are increasing and as long as my kind of fulfillment or satisfaction or happiness factor is also going up, then I think that that kind of process is worth putting faith into. The thing is, technology now has a really long history of making people live longer and better. So it's okay to some extent to put some faith into it. At the same time, I realize the technological singularity is so different than anything else we've actually ever even conceived of, that perhaps it could be the one time we made a mistake and we won't recover from. So there has to be a lot of caution, especially when we start dealing with artificial intelligence, something that really is going to be like unlike anything else, a jump unlike anything else that we've ever encountered as far as the species go. So we must be very, very careful that moment, that instant, you know, that kind of thing actually happens.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that our challenges that we have received in nature as human beings is the factor that have brought us to the point technologically and even philosophically that we are today?
I definitely think many of the challenges that nature has presented us have led us to where we are. I also think, though, that there's a certain amount of randomness in creation, and it's not always functional. And when I say it's not always functional, I mean that it may have no basis for pushing us forward. I think evolution as itself often works off something much more arbitrary. And yes, it addresses real problems, but I think at the very fundamental core of it, you have an arbitrary, perhaps fundamental arbitrary kind of point of view that occurs. That said, though, as long as it falls into normal places that are structured, we're going to be fine. So on one hand, yes, it's been nature that has directed us all along. On the other hand, I think there's a huge amount of luck and just context and consequence that has also pushed us forward. And I'm a firm believer in luck or bad luck being some of the prime movers of human experience. I know from my own life that some of the best and the worst things that have happened to me have had nothing to do with what I had hoped or what I had tried to create, but just kind of came out of the air. And I also think evolution operates like that. And I'm happy it does. It always adds that element of unknowing and of something spontaneous and something truly creative coming that can hopefully lead us to better places.
Now, are you a believer in competition as well? A kind of that we kind of a little bit alluded to earlier, the non-democratic approach, that this is just something that there are a few spearheading people that are, for whatever reason, either make and create the ideas, if you will, within the confines of their own mind, or potentially there's something else going on. Potentially they might be inspired by, you know, higher things that we do not fully have, you know, understood at this stage. But nonetheless, within that realm, you still have an idea that you have to manifest those things, right? You have to take your creativity and make it with something with your hands, or you use your mind to direct the work so that it gets done, right? So there is a core of competition at the root of this, yes?
Yes. No, I'm a pretty strong believer in competitive forces as being at least one of probably the most primary driver of a lot of evolutionary nature. So in the survival of the fittest, that is definitely an element that I do believe in. And I do believe that's the way competition unfolds. But at the same time, there's something more to that happening. There's so many other contexts and so many other consequences of the universe and just bad luck and good luck intervening. So it's not always the strongest or the smartest going to survive. It's also just sometimes who has the best kind of luck or the best skills in some certain way of bringing it a certain idea to fruition. And I think the universe operates just like this as well. I think what's happening is we have certain directions and they can deviate. I like to think of this in kind of terms of the butterfly effect. You've heard of the chaos theory where, you know, sure, a butterfly, does its wings on one side of the planet and something changes. There's so much context and consequence involved in just the overall happenings of the universe that in evolutionary terms, we can get one thing that seems to be working and then all of a sudden it can change dramatically just through a small set of other circumstances. And, The Black Swan is actually one of my favorite books. It always says that there's an anomaly out there and things can be created by anomalies. So I'm also a believer in that type of thing. So, I'm a little bit mixed. Obviously, I think competition, survival of the fittest, and all those things are proven facts. But there are more unknowns, unforeseeable, and good, bad luck type of things also pushing society forward. And also, I think, pushing in transhumanism forward in however the civilization chooses to accept it and evolve with all this type of very radical technology.
So I guess to a certain extent, then we could say that there is a recognition here that the environment itself that we've been and contained within has given us some of the challenges that led us to where we are today. And plus, on the same token, then there is some variables, I guess flukes, for the lack of a better term, black swans, what have you, that also have been there in place to give us a different parameter, if you will, so that we develop, need to do something else, right? And mix it up in that regard. So let's put that idea and oppose it to something like the technological utopia idea, that science and technology will eventually bring about a utopia, or at least help to fulfill, you know, one as close as possible to a utopian ideal. This could literally be anything that it could be some kind of Venus project type civilization, right? Where it's everything is very much controlled and managed and run, if you will, to a certain extent by robotics and computers, artificial intelligence and everything else. Everything is very much planned in that regard. It could also be the possibility that we actually upload our brains or our mind, I guess not soul then in this case, but nonetheless our essence of what we are up to a computer, and there create the environment that we live under. That would also be very much under the control and regulation of the human conditions that went into the programming of that environment. So the question there is, what will happen when and if we set ourselves outside of the parameters of the natural environment that we talked about before, that contain both things that we do understand and things that we do not understand, into an environment where everything is very much under the controlled and regulated aspects? Will we end up losing something as a human species? Will we forget? Will there be a lacking off? We will get lazy, perhaps both intellectually, of using our brains, using our bodies and everything else. There's a number of these interesting concepts that come up when you begin to examine closely where the technology actually might lead us. Thoughts on that?
Well, sure. You know, one of the great questions is, have you seen the cartoon WALL-E by chance?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I did.
So this is a classic scenario of, when a bunch of people who are very technologically advanced become just super lazy and non-productive anymore.
Right.
And it's very possible that something like that could happen. And that would be a big shame, because one of the great things I love about transhumanism is that it's an incredible adventure. It's not only an incredible adventure for the human species, but for the human mind. It's dangerous. It's fraught with challenges. It's fraught with a lot of hard. It needs a lot of hard work in order to achieve it. It needs us expanding our mind, breaking through cultural boundaries. So that's one of the things I love most about it. And if I was thinking that we were going to become something that is not as spectacular, at least as we are now, and not much more spectacular, then I would be very disappointed. And I would seriously wonder if I had been saying the wrong thing for many years. Yeah. That said, I'm hoping, very hopeful, that we are going down a path where our complexity and our ability to experience the universe and all its brilliance will only just be expanded. I don't think, as long as there's a kind of a competitive drive, a survival of the fittest built into the system, even with its anomalies, that we will necessarily ever become lazy or something where we don't want to grow, keep growing. I mean, for me, the entire thing about transhumanism is growing. It is the evolution. I'm constantly becoming a better entity. I'm constantly becoming, just like the book says, I'm trying to become an all-powerful, omnipotent entity. And that's, for me, the journey is what is so brilliant. You know, I'll worry about the end result when I actually get there, but I'm hoping in the meantime that we will continue and never become a worse off species than we are right now. There's obviously a lot of dangers, though, that we could go down the wrong path and end up something that's a lot further different than what we ever wanted.
Right, right. Do you see some of the comparisons with religion within the movement itself? I mean, you alluded to this earlier as well, but because of the idea that there is a technology, there's a belief in the church of progress, for the lack of a better term, right? There is, the technology is going to solve everything. There is faith in the picture. There is a belief in maybe not an afterlife, but a post-death society. Potentially mankind's idea and concept of a omnipotent being, like God in that case, would potentially be an artificial intelligence system that has oversight over everything, sees and hears everything in that regard. It's all the components are there. And I've suspected for a long time that there's one of the attractions within the movement itself. Maybe that's a subconscious aspect in terms of why certain people who are primarily, I guess, atheists, drawn to the movement in itself without really understanding it. Some might, and they might just like it for what it is anyway, right? But there is a parallel there to me when I look at both of the different religiosities from the outside and see that there's an attraction to the system because they very much contain a lot of the same components and elements. Would you agree with that?
Oh, 100%. And I even though I've written a very anti-religious novel, The Transhumanist Wager, I am very much at least very much understand that transhumanism as a whole, especially in some of the questions you've just been asking the last 15 minutes, technological singularity, they get so speculative and so philosophical that they're truly spiritual questions. We are talking about consciousness in such a different way than we are experiencing right now, that it gets into something that could only, it could be defined as something almost religious. And yes, I realize there's no omnipotent God out there, or there's no other divine forces, but it carries on a very, the spiritual overtones are immense. And I do think that is an attraction, especially to some of the younger transhumanists, is that it merges many of the cultural myths that we have grown up with, except gives it into a perspective that is modern. Is something that we can say, well, I'm not behind the times, I'm really cool, I'm with it, but at the same time, it's very much, new. It feels shiny, it feels great, it feels brilliant. It's something almost on par with what the experience you might have in if you were religious. And I think that's an important part of transhumanism. I don't emphasize that part because I'm tend to be an atheist, but it does also represent quite a lot of the brilliance for me that living indefinitely is, in a way, joining with something that we have all known as divine, and the singularity in itself, an artificial intelligence, could be something that could be akin to an omnipotent entity. In fact, we might be in a simulation theory already, where we already are controlled by some omnipotent entity or some alien entity or something like that. And this is just a game to recreate that, or this is just some type of endeavor to become that entity itself. There are arguments for all these things, and I love that aspect about transhumanism, even though I don't really write about it in my book. I think it's very important because it attracts a huge, broad crowd to the movement, and everyone can sort of find what they want in it and still move forward with technology.
What about the question of enforcement? There are a couple of scenarios in the novel as well where there is a kind of an enforcement of the ideal itself, right? It's mandatory education, right? It's a mandatory way of life, really. There's an adaptation that needs to occur of the transhumanist ideal, kind of, or else, right? There's a question of, for example, the overpopulation that you brought up before, reproductive limitations and everything else. It's very much of a guided experience for people who enter into that world, or at that stage are actually forced into that world. So how much of that is something that's you think needs to be applied to the real world?
Well, here's the tough questions. I'm going to stand behind the book on virtually everything, almost everything. I do believe that it would be in the species' best interest to give licenses to people that would like to have children. We have so much, what do we have? I think 19 or 20,000 children have starved today to death. In fact, I guess 1,500 in the last hour or two that we've been talking have died and starved to death. They should not have been born. And anyone that says it is endorsing or condoning some type of form of murder, in my opinion. So I'm very strong in that saying that we must be very careful that we don't allow such suffering to occur just in order to protect this thing we would call individual rights, because there's a substantial portion of the population out there that has no idea how to honor that sense of individual rights. And so I do believe in that case that there should be some type of process. Now, I can tell you right now off the bat, I'm not a fan of the government. And I know in the book, it talks about the government being responsible for those potential licenses. It's not something that I like. It's just the only way I'd seen out of it. There could be a better system made. I don't know if it would be through a nonprofit or through a voting system of a certain society of tribes and stuff like that. It's very difficult to know. But one thing is for sure, not everyone should have children and not everyone should be allowed to. Because there are just too many hardships out there that kids go through that they shouldn't go through. And it's only because they're born into this world from parents who really didn't deserve to ever have that. And I'll answer the other I know that's a very controversial thing. In fact, it's very interesting. In an entire year since this book has been out, this is one of the very first times I've been asked that incredibly controversial question. Happy to actually answer it, because it is something that one day, hopefully in the next few months, I will write an article on. I know everyone will be very upset on. You know, the other question about
let's not leave the topic though. Let's stay on it a little bit longer. Yeah. So
great.
But starvation, right? That is part of nature. Again, there's something within the environment where we have been born into that enables any of our species of any, you know, animal that's on the planet to either live or die, right? There's either a survival mechanism there. It's even, of course, a very old fundamental edict that for something to live, there has to be a death of some kind. There is a renewal and a cycle within the natural system. And even starvation, as brutal as that is, as horrible as that is to witness, of course, it doesn't. I'm just excluding the very concept that, of course, that there is other people there to help. There's other things in place to prevent those things. I, for example, myself, am a firm believer in that if we had a overall better system of running things on this planet, we wouldn't see the starvation that we see. We wouldn't even potentially see the numbers of population among some demographics, for example, in the kind of number ratio that there are. But nonetheless, just the basic aspect that starvation and the brutality that some people call it that we see in the nature is all part of that. And that's something that even has enabled us from the beginning to even be here. At what point do you think then that an external group, politicians, administrative group, a non-governmental organization, whatever group you want to imagine there, should come in to try to prevent certain things from happening, right? How do you administer that, and who should make those decisions?
Yes, this is incredibly difficult, but you know, I'm still just, if I was there on the ground watching these children starve to death and die, like literally dropping, I think all of us, whatever it is in us, would make us say, well, something must be done. And I agree with you. You know, I'm not a fan of the licensing idea. If there was another method to do, like we could actually go in there and stop it, because, for example, we would take resources from here or there and do it, that might be better. But I try to solve things I try to solve things in ways that I believe are actually solvable, you know. And I also try to do things that instill discipline by creating a system where people have to earn that right. They might take having children much more seriously. The after effects could be incredible. Every single child would be wanted, would be loved, would be treated, given the best education that they could. All these things to turn out to be truly superhuman beings. That's the world I'm after, and that's kind of what the Transhumanist Wager, the novel, is all about: is creating a universe where every single person is at the maximum that they can be—a world of superhumans. And so that is the kind of thing I would like to do. Unfortunately, you know, getting down to politics, getting down to 7 billion people, what is the easiest and what is the quickest way to tell people that, you know, what is the right thing to do? And this is kind of how I came up with this idea. How would we administer these things? This would be a bureaucratic nightmare to do such a thing. However, China seemed to, you know, go, they had a policy that, you know, it was different than this, but it did work for them to a certain extent.
But that's communism. Then, I mean, again, that's what I find so interesting with your philosophy, Zoltan. It's like you have Ayn Rand on the wallpaper there, and then all of a sudden you're like into this completely other totalitarian dictatorship kind of mindset here, right?
No, of course. And, you know, and I think so many people actually, they want to label exactly what the philosophy of the Transhumanist Wager is. And I can tell you in just one simple word what the philosophy of the Transhumanist Wager is: it's functionality. It does not care what is right or wrong. It does not care what is protective or non-protective. It does not care if it's libertarian or socialist. And I keep getting everyone always like, oh, it's a libertarian novel. I didn't choose for it to be mostly libertarian. It came out as libertarian because those were the most rational ideas at the time when I was constructing this philosophy and this this storyline.
So it's kind of utilitarianism, really.
It is, but I don't want to exactly classify it as that either, because it does want to incorporate, the utilitarianism is based on trying to live indefinitely. And also it's based on this concept of each individual striving to become the single strongest entity that they can become. And utilitarian is often the greater good, you know, trying to promote the greater good. In this case, it's actually the individual good. So it merges a lot of those different worlds. It's like everyone wants the greatest individual good. Okay, now go forth. What's the most functional political and social philosophy for the greatest individual good of every single person on the planet? And so I don't know exactly if I should have called it like a post-utilitarianism or something like this, but it is a collection of many of those ideas, including going to your original, one of your original ideas, questions of, you know, socializing education. Simply, I believe every single person on the planet should be put through the system and given that type of education. For anyone to miss it makes it just very difficult to, it puts other people at a complete disadvantage to those that have been educated. And there we get into some of this class structure stuff that I'm not a fan of. I would like to see everyone start off from the exact same playing field and let the best person win.
Okay. My question again, then, that you didn't answer earlier regarding Chai Lai's idea, their population control, really, ultimately. You mentioned that they need to earn the right. And my question again, who do they need to earn the right to? Because this, to me, sounds very much, for example, you had some of the Fabian socialists like George Bernard Shaw had an interesting video there up on YouTube where he mentions how people should be brought for a committee to justify their existence so that someone can kind of judge their usefulness, if you will, to the greater good of the society. And is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, I am suggesting something like that, but it's not as formal as that. And I'm not suggesting that people necessarily need to justify their own personal existence. What I think they need to justify, even though later in the novel, and it foreshadows that exact thing. When I talk about the humanicide formula, that is exact, which is kind of an artificial intelligence construct, maybe 20 years into the future. The sequel will be about that. I definitely start putting forth those ideas that people need to justify their existence. However, what I'm suggesting now, and I would advocate today openly, is that people should come in front of a committee or a group of people or something and say, and they need to be asked, well, what is it that you could give to this child that you're planning on having that's going to make society feel that you're worth being good parents for? And I realize that takes away their individual liberty of having children entirely. But at the same time, you know, we've already done that in many ways. You know, the state owns children in many respects. If I do something awful to my child, the state will come and take it. So we have already given up certain rights. This is just taking it a step further and saying, well, if you're not going to feed the child, you're not going to give it an education, you're not going to give it a house and love and the care that it needs to grow in to be a productive transhumanist, a productive human being, then we don't want you to have the children at all. So that's the kind of thing that I would be asking, although I really like George Bernard Shaw's idea as well.
Wow. Well, I couldn't fundamentally disagree more with you on this point. So in other words, how aware are you of political... the geopolitical game and corruption within the political system and political conspiracy?
So, you know, Henrik, I'm very aware of it. But the problem here is that I'm an idealist and, you know, I write things and you know this, and I think a lot of people know this when they read my book. You're talking like sort of like Ayn Rand. You talk about blacks and whites. You create characters that are extremes of everything and you hope for the best. In the real world, the best never occurs. It's much more gray. It's much more mixed. Things never get done. There's bureaucracy. There's criminality within governments and stuff like this that slow up everything. And then there's good and bad luck and stuff like that we had discussed earlier. So it's probably impossible that a system, well, I'm not going to say it's impossible, but it's probably very difficult to get a system that would ever actually be able to license out people having... saying yay or nay to having children, because then there'd be so much corruption built in, or some people wouldn't get it based on, you know, whimsical. Maybe the person deciding that day had a bad fight with his wife and he doesn't want to be nice to
right.
the person
it, it
he's
wouldn't
judging.
Be, it wouldn't be objective, correct?
It would not be objective. And that's where this idea has the deepest problems, because is it worth taking away such liberties in order to have a system that's judging you be not a foolproof system to begin with?
Because at the root of this, it's. I mean, what's your issue with it really here? If we try to come down to it, is it the safety issue or is it the, I mean, okay, this radical totalitarian issue is based on on trying to prevent suffering, correct? Or enforcing safety, right?
So that's definitely some of it. The other greater point, though, I think, is the idea that I am trying to create a world where every entity on the planet maximizes its value, maximizes its ability to contribute towards an overall transhumanist mindset and the evolution of the species itself. And so, yes, in one way, it's like, you know, I'm trying not to take away individual liberties and I'm trying to abolish suffering. But at the same time, I'm looking for a grander transhumanist picture. I want to create a transhumanist inspired world, and I want to do whatever are the most functional and useful steps towards achieving that.
But do you see that there is a contradiction here? Because of what you suggest as a process, you are effectively going to enforce the suffering that you're trying to prevent in the first place.
I'm not sure that you can, I mean, there's multiple ways of looking at it. I don't think I'm necessarily, you know, there's going to be a little bit of suffering no matter what happens. We're looking for the end result here to be that there's going to be a lot less suffering. In fact, as I get into one of the main articles I wrote early on about 5-6 months ago was, should hindering life extension science be a crime? And it's based on one of the concepts in my book, which is what is human life hours worth? And when you look at suffering, suffering is something that is kind of difficult to quantify, but life hours are very easy to quantify. Everybody on the planet has a certain amount of life hours that they can live. And everyone has a maximum amount of life hours and a minimum amount of life hours. And the goal of transhumanists and the goal of people that are actually humanitarian should be to maximize those life hours. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to pick a philosophy that maximizes the life hours of the people that exist on the planet now and make them as fruitful and as productive as possible. I don't really look at those potential life hours, and I don't look at the life hours that have already, you know, that people that have died. I just look at whoever is here now. And I'm a firm believer that we can maximize the transhumanist agenda by taking those people who are alive right now and, you know, helping them to realize the greatest things that they can do for this overall transhumanist world. And again, that goes back to whether they should have children. If they're going to bring in transhumanist-inspired children, then I love it. It's great. But if they're going to bring in children that are going to starve to death and take resources and cause pain and suffering, I'm absolutely against it.
So what would happen to me when I resist this?
Oh, well, so this gets into a much more difficult part of me personally. Jethro Knights would say, you know, you're probably going to go to jail or something like that. Personally,
who's going to accept this? That's just ridiculous.
Oh, no, of course. And again, that's why I chose to write a novel instead of a nonfiction book.
Yeah, but it's still your ideology and philosophy behind it, right? So this is what you're advocating.
Well, it's important that, you know, just from a purely philosophical point of view, it's important to advocate ideas that ask us new questions, because that's how society and civilization move forward. Now, nobody likes that. You know, I mean, I can tell you most of my articles get, you know, that's why my book got hate mail to begin with, and it still does occasionally. But the idea is that we push different buttons, we pick the things we like. Some things of the transhumanist wager contribute to the overall goal of the species and civilization. Other things go to trash. That's okay. That's sort of the nature of the visionary and what they're trying to do. In the end of the day, I'm hoping that what I've done actually contributes something. It gets people to think. Maybe no one will be able to enforce this, and the world will end up in chaos, and then it'll be have been a very bad idea. But at the same time, I think considering it is something that's very important. It forces us to ask, well, why aren't we doing this? Why are children dying? Is there another method? As you had suggested before, there must be other methods to do so that we can alleviate suffering and get the planet to living healthier and longer lives.
Because the very incentive, as I understand from the book as well, for this method is to stop, for example, religious intolerance and everything else that's been subjected to, so-called terrorism. I mean, there's a whole bag of, you know, can of worms there that we don't need to open at this minute because we don't have enough time. But nonetheless, with this, what you're suggesting is they would just be replaced by a new totalitarian system. It would just be a different flavor because, again, who is to determine what productivity is, or who is to make a value judgment on the efficiency of these life hours that you mentioned before? You have to have a a transhumanist manifesto, and where's Karl Marx, right?
So, you know, of course, and that's why this novel has been called, totalitarian to begin with.
Right.
And it's certain fascist and all these other things. It's very much those things. The thing, though, is that it once it accomplishes what it wants, it pulls away from that. As you know, from the end of the book, without giving it away, though, Jethro, after 20 years of tyranny, gives the world back to a form of democracy. It's not that democracy is a bad thing. It's just sometimes it's not the right thing. Yeah, but
then you've purged all those human beings that are quote-unquote undesirables. What is that?
Well, I mean, he doesn't purge them.
No, not personally per se, but of course the resistance to this method of this is now how we're going to live. I mean, this is, how is that not mass murder then? And again, how is that? I mean, don't you see the contradiction that this is, it's enforcement of suffering?
Yes, no, it is enforcement of short-term suffering for the greater good.
Oh, boy.
And,
okay.
You know, and getting into a point, I mean, I realize that all dictators and all totalitarian people have said this.
But your method is the right one, correct? That's why this needs to be enforced.
It is. No, but, you know, one must believe that it is the right one. And I do believe that it could be in the best interest of civilization to have a stronger sense of ethics, a stronger sense of morality in dealing with the future. And this is really what the transhumanist wager is about. It's designed to challenge us, to ask us, are we strong enough to deal with artificial intelligence? Are we strong enough to deal with the technological singularity? We might need a much stronger moral system. And the moral system is built into my novel, which says, hey, no more of this wimpy stuff. I realize everyone loves democracy. I realize everyone wants liberty and stuff like this. But that may not be what gets the species to survive the coming transition we're going through. It may take a much firmer stance of morals and ideologies about how we react to this incredible technological phenomenon that's going to take place in the next 20, 30 years. And that's one of the most important things that comes out about the book.
All right. Well, I see democracy as totalitarian, actually. Majority rules, right? It has nothing to do with true liberty. And I do have an idea there that a counter argument here would be the kind of a laissez-faire approach, whatever area of life it actually is, that those who will manage that there is a natural balance in nature, including the world that the humankind set up. And there is nothing wrong with a lion that feeds on a gazelle. There is a portion of suffering that enables life to exist on the planet. And so I'm just interested in many of the contradictions that I'm hearing within your philosophy that I'm trying to piece them together and understand, basically, Zoltan, of how you're, because to me it sounds like doublethink to a certain extent, well, to a certain extent, very much like doublethink, right?
Well, it certainly is. And I think, you know, the thing is, we all think doublethink is something that's negative or awful. But again, when you're taking a truly utilitarian approach, there's no such thing as doublethink. You just simply, every single time you have a dilemma or a question, you ask yourself, what is the most functional perspective to take at that moment, given the long-term goals that you're after? And if that requires a totalitarian government, or that requires going to a democratic government, that requires that. If that requires licensing for children, you know, childbirths or not, then that's what it requires. You just simply always choose the method that leads to the quickest and most expedient method that would lead to the most transhumanist-inspired world that you can find, especially given all the life hours and lifespans of everyone on the planet. I like to think of everyone as being valuable, everyone being able to contribute. So I look for maximizing everyone in the way that is most possible. I realize that that's an idealist perspective. It's probably very difficult to ever achieve such a thing. However, you know, as a philosopher, those are the ideas that I want to bring forth, because it gets people to think, well, maybe there are improvements that we can make. And in no way do I think that these ideas are going to be implemented, but it's great to think about them. It's great to think maybe there are parts of them that actually can help the species out quite dramatically.
Do you, to a certain extent, wish and maybe even hope that an artificial intelligence, potentially through a robotic enforcement, would make this task so that it wouldn't be touched by any humans, so they would have to be part of the purge?
So this gets into the most interesting thing is, and I've been recently saying this, is that I actually believe that the transhumanist wager, the novel itself, will be more popular once artificial intelligence is here, because it essentially is, in my idea, bringing forth a moral system of the future. It's not a moral system that anyone can accept for exactly the reasons that you have just brought up. You've brought up some incredible arguments, and they're very difficult. They just don't make us feel good. It makes us feel like, wow, something is, this guy wants to take away all the liberties. But I believe as we evolve.
In life?
Yeah, as in life. As we evolve, though, into different types of entities, different types of creatures, more functional, we might say, you know what, it's not that important. I'm not worried about surveillance. I'm not worried about some of these liberties. What I'm worried about now is functionality. And this is where the transhumanist wager gets very good in its philosophy. And I often say that the transhumanist wager itself is a bridge to artificial intelligence. It's a bridge to the kind of moral system that you're going to see a computer look towards putting forth into the world rather than people.
But someone ultimately is going to program the artificial intelligence, no matter if it's a one that actually upgrades its own algorithms, its own coding, if you will. Someone will have the backdoor. Someone will have the server key. Someone will oversee the process. As we know from history, just watching at some dictators trying to take over the war machines in various countries, and some in cases even building it up from ground up, right? That's what they would do. They would seek where does the most power lie in terms of controlling the human experience, and they would seek actively 100% of their entire time dedicated to try to get control over this power to be able to satisfy their need, their tyrannical need, really. So there is no protection from anything like that, right? And so the system itself, to a certain extent, as far as I understand it, that's there to prevent these things, would in fact be the enabler.
Yes. Well, so these are going to be some of the catch-22s that come up. The idea is there a fail-safe switch built in? It's very likely that a machine will upgrade itself and be able to pull the fail-safe switch. So I'm not a big believer that. I think once the programming's in, it's going to be rewritten probably within the first 24 hours. There might be some things that a machine can't do, but I think true artificial intelligence, once it gets going, we're going to have to be incorporated into it immediately, like upon the first instance, in order to not have it run free or not have it go way beyond us and evolve way out of our reach. But, you know, going back to your question, I would think that it would be interesting if we did have something like an artificial intelligence come, and there's been some classic science fiction movies like this, help us lead. As I've said in some of my articles, artificial intelligence is going to solve half the problems we have probably in the first month of its existence, environmentally, physics-wise, biologically, all these things. And they're going to become in many ways some of the almost like gods to us if we just remain who we are and we don't integrate ourselves with them. And so I think there's a huge amount to learn from that, and it may be for the best of the species to have something like that. Though I find it hard to believe that governments would allow that to happen. I think the more likely scenario is that we would become integrated with them slowly, and it'd be a very monitored process. In fact, I'm sure that there'll be a giant conflict right before that moment. I think many humans will say no to artificial intelligence, and many technologists will say yes, and you will see something like my book, The Religious Conflict, unfold in the streets.
All right. Now, of course, have you looked into the health issues at all in terms of the taking of steroids for various implants, specifically if they're non-organic and everything else? We have another situation of the Wi-Fi alone, of course, which actually degenerates the DNA and actually breaks it down over a multi-generational order, so that in 2-3 generations from now, if we have been subjected to Wi-Fi throughout our life, that affects our not only our sperm, of course, men is practically going infertile at this stage, which I think would be actually another incentive for why the transhumanists would want to come in and actually take over the whole reproduction role again. But again, that very much of this comes from the technology that we've developed so far. We have a tremendous rise in brain cancers around some of the cell phone areas where the towers have gone up. There's a couple of universities in the States, I think, in San Francisco, where there's this death room called Room 88 because it's adjacent just to one of the cell phone towers, and it's a major place where actually a lot of the students get brain cancer and everything else. So with a more interconnected world, with all this communication going on, as we're bathing in a sea of Wi-Fi and everything else, this might actually be the thing that actually breaks the back of the human species if we do not revert and try to improve the technology or just let it go altogether. What do you say to this?
Well, I think you're onto something that I would agree with, that we do need to be very careful. In the end of the day, I subscribe to, you know, what people might call various conspiracy theories, and I also am worried about them. Even though I am very much a pro transhumanist and push forth the agenda and all that, I am always looking around saying, well, who's doing this? What's doing what? Is there an agenda? Because as I pointed out, I'm in some of the other interviews, I'm not that 1% elite. I don't belong to that class, and I'm not doing anything like that. So I am pushing forth something. I hope I'm not pushing it forth for some kind of group or anything like that. I think we should always look at some of the things you've just mentioned as potentially dangerous, constantly revisit them, set up groups and entities to look at all that, and make sure that we don't end up shooting ourselves in the foot, or even worse, eliminating ourselves just because we didn't have the foresight to move perhaps a little bit slower, or in a way that didn't save, a certain portion of the species should something go completely wrong. I also worry about, for example, everyone's using cell phones, and there's been a little bit of studies on brain cancer and stuff like that. The problem is now everyone uses it, and it hasn't been long enough to actually know how some of those studies work. You know, this is the classic one where I subscribe to it as well, but I'm also a little bit worried. And so I think some of the things you've mentioned are incredibly important. And while I'm very, pro moving forward, I would also be just as much saying it's worth making sure that these things are actually going to lead to the kinds of advances that we want civilization to go down, lest something terrible happen and all my stupid ideas look crazy in 20 years when the world has faltered.
Yeah, I mean, it's smart meters. There are people that are dying now from brain cancer from it. I think smart meters operate on a little bit of a higher frequency, but cell phones, it's roughly around 2.4 gigahertz. Some, of course, Wi-Fi modems is going into the 5 gigahertz right now, but 2.4, that's just about the range of a microwave. So the question is, of course, if you would put your head in the microwave and turn that on, it was effectively be the same, since some of the damage that's caused in the DNA is accumulative as well, right? So it breaks down over time. You have to do tremendous amounts of melatonin to be able to resist this to have a huge impact on your brain. But I think that, I guess some of the listeners might think that you are part of that little clique that is depicted in the Elysium, for example, right? We have this kind of off-world civilization that goes off and they develop a space station where they live happily ever after. What would you say to those people who consider you to be one among those?
So, yeah, I know a lot of people say that. I would just say that I'm not aware of those things happening. I am actually, especially because of some of the interviews I've done recently, I've become more aware because of interviews like you, or to look into that. And I'm not going to say that that's not happening. I'm not going to say that. I hope I'm not a pawn of any sort of agenda like that. I actually just simply am a human being who wants to live indefinitely. But I do believe it's very important, as technology progresses, that we keep a very close eye on some of those incredibly wealthy people and people closest to the technology, because there may be a point in time when someone can really make a leap that is so far advanced that they become somebody that is too powerful to stop, or some group that is too powerful to stop. And I can assure you, as a man with two daughters and a happy life in San Francisco, I'm probably not going to be part of that group. So I don't want to have that happen to me. I like a lot of the freedoms and stuff I have. I know that seems to contradict some of the other ideas, but a lot of my ideas are quite speculative and are just there to get us to move forward slowly, step by step, and as a society as a whole. But I am still very cautious of, as you have pointed out, and many others have pointed out in the last few months to me, that there are agendas at work, and there might be people that are thinking things that are not going to be beneficial for myself, my family, and huge other amounts of people around the world.
I can, at this stage in my life, of all the research I've done, I can guarantee it. There are actually some really good documentaries that I'll send you if you have an open mind, if you have the time, that is, that definitely shows that there's a part of a very advanced, updated eugenics agenda in the works that actually demonstrates that this is most definitely going on. And I think that a lot of people are attracted to transhumanism because of the, of course, the potential and the allure in itself of the technological update of what might be possible. But I think we should be not only cautious, we should be absolutely we have to be very, you know, vigilant in terms of what we accept and what we adopt because of this very fact that we do have, you know, conspiring men over us, and we do have people who are making agendas. This, see, the eugenics agenda that's been going on for a long time, and what people don't understand is that this has been updated along the way as new, you know, the people from Bertrand Russell and all the way up through, you know, Huxley and H.G. Wells and all these other Fabian socialists that come along as well have suggested a lot of the things that we actually have in the works today. And I think that there's a really interesting trend in terms of the black ops development, the kind of the off-budget stuff as well, not what we see officially released from DARPA and, you know, Boston Dynamics and everything else, but something much more advanced that already actually is in place. So we have some of that kind of stuff, and we can definitely show it to you if you're interested in it, Sultan.
Yes, no, please send me the links. I would love, I know I watch documentaries every single night, so I am all about watching as many as I can.
All right, well, this has been very interesting. There's a couple of more questions, I guess, I want to fire off before we wrap things up for this time. We went a little bit over the time, but it's been just been very interesting talking with you and try to understand the basic philosophy that you're suggesting and advocating here. And by the way, do you know if Huffington Post endorses a lot of your ideas?
No, I don't think that they endorse any of those, any of my ideas. I just think that they are luckily allowing me to publish and try to ask new questions that hopefully push people forward. But I certainly don't think that I can tell you also some articles that I have written have not been accepted there. And so it's not like everything that I actually put through gets there. So I want to say they definitely do not endorse, but they've been kind enough to let me push forth some of the, you know, basic ideas of transhumanism so that others, you know, that the mainstream media world can just consider them.
Well, I don't want to ostracize you, obviously. I always appreciate talking with people, especially that I don't agree with, so that I can learn, so that I can understand, so that I can sharpen my own philosophical ideas and being challenged as well in my own belief system, so I can see and test those theories, right? That's how it goes. So I can't, you know, I want to, I probably, the, a lot of people who are listening virtually anyway would say that, oh my God, this is genocide 2.0, right? This is transhumanist eugenics, really. So if there's anything that you could leave us with, Zoltan, as a method to endorse your idea, why should anyone take your philosophy seriously after everything that we've been talking about today?
Well, I think for the most important reason is because each and every single one of us, me, you, and all your listeners, are going to die. And if there really is in the 21st century, and I believe there is, I believe we're at the cusp of it, there is a way to eliminate death, eliminate suffering, eliminate disease, then as a species that really enjoys life, we should put our resources towards that. We should put our time, our energy, everything we can towards this so that we can live longer, so that I don't have to ever watch a child die, or I don't ever have to watch myself or my parents die. We can all live indefinitely and figure out ways to solve the other problems that are out there. That's what I would like to leave, you know, the listeners with. And ultimately, I realize that there's a lot of different angles to transhumanism, and some are conspiracy theories, some are very fanatically pro-transhumanism, some are like my ideas, which are a bit all over the place, eclectic, also quite visionary, quite far out there. But the idea is that we can use technology and science to improve life and improve life and lengthen lifespans. I hope that your listeners out there will be cautious, take in some of the cautionary things that you have said, but also embrace the idea that we can use science and technology in a good way to make human life better. In fact, much, much better.
All right. Well, I actually had many more questions for it, but we'll end for now, and maybe we can do that at another point. But let's give out the websites again, Zoltan, and again, if people want to pick up a copy of the book and read more, as there's a couple of things, obviously, that we didn't have time to get to today that's contained within the book quite a bit, actually. So give us that again so people know where to go.
Absolutely. And Henrik, thank you so much for having me on your show. I appreciate your tough questions. And I it's been a great conversation. I'm sorry it's so short, too. But you can find my novel, The Transhumanist Wager, on Amazon. And just type in Amazon and type in The Transhumanist Wager. And you can pick it up there. And you can also pick it up in a few bookstores. It's the easiest to get it online, though. And my website is transhumanistwager.com. And my Huffington Post blog is just go to Huffington Post and type in my name. And I also have a blog on Psychology Today called The Transhumanist Philosopher. And just if you want to look at more information, just Google my name. And there's a ton of either reviews. Some are horrible. Some are wonderful for my novel. And I've heard that reading the comments And the reviews of my novel are almost more interesting than reading the novel itself, because some are so passionate one way or the other.
All right. Thanks, Sultan.
Thank you.
Well, 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 there you go. What do you think about that? I hope you have some new things to consider and think about. Please share your thoughts on redeyesmembers.com, where you can comment on our program and see what other members think. This is a topic that we'll keep monitoring and continue to examine in some detail. As technology develops, it might be one that potentially could become our worst enemy, at least in the hands of psychotic leaders and people devoid of connection to the natural world and natural order and reality in general. We'll be back with more in just a few days with Maria Kvilhaug from Norway to talk about Norse mythology and Viking history as one of the most interesting chapters in Scandinavian history. Have a great day. I hope you don't have too many nightmares tonight. Please accept my apologies if you do, but I think it's essential that we do face these topics and talk about them. So thank you for your interest, and thank you for caring about reality and what really is happening in this world. Many thanks. Take good care. We'll talk to you in just a few.